"I have obtained your workers for you," Mech told Nicholas as they began the march up the valley the next morning. "My Metemma has promised to give us 100 men within 2 days and another 500 to follow them within the next week. He is handing out indulgences to all those who volunteer to work on the dam. They will be spared the fires of purgatory if they take part in such a glorious project as the recovery of the holy relic of Saint Antonia." Both the women stopped in their tracks and stared at him. "What did you promise the poor old man?" Tessé demanded. "A body to replace the one that Nogo plundered from the church. If we do discover the tomb, then the monastery's share will be the mummy of Mamos." "That's a mean thing to do," Royan exploded. "You will cheat him into helping us." "It is not a cheat," Mech's dark eyes flashed at the accusation. "The relic that they lost was not the veritable body of St. Frumentius, and yet for hundreds of years it served the purpose of uniting the community of monks and drawing Christians from all over this land. Now that it is gone, the very existence of the monastery is threatened. They have lost their reason for continuing." "So you are tempting them with a false promise," Royan was still angry. "The body of Mamos is every bit as authentic as the one they lost. What does it matter if it is the body of an ancient Egyptian rather than that of an ancient Christian? Just as long as it serves as a focus for the faith, and if it is the means by which the monastery might survive for another 500 years? "I think Mech is making sense," Nicholas gave his opinion. "Since when have you been an expert in Christianity? You are an atheist," Royan flashed at him, and he held up his hands as if to ward off the blow. "You're right. What do I know about it anyway? You argue it out with Mech. I'm going to discuss the theory of dam building with Sapper Webb." He sauntered up to the head of the file of men and fell in beside his engineer. From time to time he heard heated voices raised behind him, and he grinned. He knew Mech, but he was also beginning to understand the lady. It would be fascinating to see who would win this argument. They reached the head of the chasm in the middle of the afternoon, and while Mech searched out a campsite, Nicholas took Sapper immediately to the narrow neck of the river, just above where it plunged over the waterfall. While Sapper set up the theodolite, Nicholas took the graduated levelling staff. Sapper ordered him up and down the face of the cliff with peremptory hand signals, all the while peering into the lens of the theodolite, while Nicholas teetered on insecure footing and tried to keep the staff upright for Sapper to take his sightings. "Okay," Sapper bellowed after taking his 20th shot. "Now I want you on the other side of the river." "Fine," Nicholas bellowed back. "Do you want me to fly or swim?" Nicholas hiked 3 miles upstream to the ford, where the trail crossed the Dundera River, and then fought his way back through the tangled riverine undergrowth to the point on the bank opposite, which Sapper lay in the shade smoking a soothing cigarette. "Don't rupture yourself, will you?" Nicholas yelled across the water at him. It was almost dark before Sapper had made all the shots he wanted, and Nicholas was still faced with the long return trip over the ford. He covered the last mile in almost total darkness, guided only by the flicker of the campfires. Wearily he stumbled into the camp and flung down the levelling staff. "You'd better tell me that it was worth it," he growled at Sapper, who did not look up from his slide rule. He was working over his revised drawings by the glaring light of a small butane lantern. "You weren't too far out in your estimates," he congratulated Nicholas. "The river is 41 yards wide at the critical point above the falls, where I want to site the structure." "All I want to know is if you will be able to throw a dam across it." Sapper grinned and laid his finger down the side of his nose. "You get me my ruddy front ender, and I'll dam the bleeding Nile itself." After they had eaten their dinner, another of the rat packs, Royan glanced across the fire at Nicholas. When she caught his eye, she inclined her head in invitation. Then she stood up and casually drifted out of camp, looking back once to make sure he was following her. Nicholas lighted the path with his torch as they picked their way back to the dam site and found a boulder overlooking the water on which to sit. He switched off the torch, and they were silent for a while as their eyes adjusted to the starlight. And then Royan whispered, There were times that I thought we would never return here, that it was all a dream, and that Taita's pool never existed. For us, perhaps it never will, without the help of the monks from the monastery. There was a note of inquiry in his voice. You and McNamara win, she chuckled softly. Of course, we have to accept their help. Mech's arguments were very convincing. So you agree that their reward should be the mummy of Mamose? I agree that they may take whatever mummy we discover, if we discover one at all, she qualified. For all we know, the true mummy of Mamose may be the one that Nogo stole. Quite naturally, he slipped his arm around her shoulders, and after a moment she relaxed against him. Oh, Nicky, I am afraid and excited, afraid that all our hopes are vain, and excited that we might have found the key to Taita's game. She turned her face to his, and he felt her breath on his lips. He kissed her tenderly. Then he drew back with the warmth of her lingering on his lips and studied her face in the starlight. She made no movement to pull away from him. Instead, she swayed towards him and kissed him back. At first, it was a staid sisterly kiss, with her mouth tightly closed. He brought his right hand up behind her head and weaved his fingers into her hair, holding her face to his. He opened his mouth over hers, and she made a little sound of dissent through her closed lips. Slowly, voluptuously, he worked her lips apart, and her protests died away as he probed her mouth deeply with his tongue. She was making a contented little mewling sound now, like a kitten nursing on the teat, and her arms went around him. She kneaded his back with strong, supple fingers, her mouth wide open to his kiss, her tongue sinuous and slippery as it twined around his. He slid his other hand up between their bodies and unhooked the buttons of her shirt down as low as her belt. She leaned back slightly in his embrace to make it easier for him. With a delicious shock, he discovered that her breasts were naked under the thin cotton shirt. He cupped one of them in his hand. It was small and firm, only just filling his hand. When he pinched the nipple gently, it stiffened between his fingers like a tiny ripe strawberry. He broke off the kiss and bowed his head to her bosom. She moaned softly and with one hand guided him down. When he sucked her nipple into his mouth, she gasped and hooked the nails of her other hand into his back, like a cat responding to a caress. Her whole body undulated in his embrace, and after a while she pulled his mouth away. He thought for a moment that she was rejecting him, but then she moved his head across and placed her other nipple in his mouth. Once again she gasped as he sucked it in. Her movements became more abandoned, keeping pace with his own arousal. He could restrain himself no longer, and he reached up under her khaki culottes and laid his hand on the plump mound of her sex. Then, with one swift, lithe movement, she broke away and sprang to her feet. She stood back from him, smoothing down her culottes and buttoning her shirt with fingers that trembled. I am so sorry, Nicky. I want to. Oh, God, you'll never know how much I want to, but... She shook her head and she was panting wildly. Not yet. Please, Nicky, forgive me. I am caught between two worlds. One half of me wants this so very much. But the other half will not allow me. He stood up and kissed her chastely. There is no hurry. Good things are worth waiting for, he told her with his mouth just touching hers. Come. I will take you home now. While it was still dark the next morning, the first levy of priests that Maimatima had promised came filing up the valley. Their chanting awoke the camp, and everyone came sleepily out of their thatched lean-to shelters to welcome the long column of holy men.
Oh, sweet heavens, Nicholas yawned. It looks as though we've started another crusade.
They must have left the monastery in the middle of the night to get here at this hour. He went to find Tessé. And when he did, he told her, You are hereby appointed official translator. Sapper speaks not a word of either Arabic or Amharic. Stick close to him. As soon as it was fully light, Mech and Nicholas left camp to reconnoitre a drop site. By noon they had agreed that there was only one possibility, they would have to use the valley itself. Compared to the rocky ridges that surrounded them, the floor of the valley was level and fairly free of obstructions. It was imperative that the drop should take place as close to the dam site as possible, for every mile that the stores must be manhandled would add immeasurably to the time and effort needed for the work. Time is the major factor, Nicholas told Mech as they stood in the chosen drop zone the following morning. Every day counts from now until the rains break. Mech looked up at the sky. Pray God for late rains. They marked out their drop site a mile down from the river, along the stretch where the valley was widest, and there was a clear approach through the gap in the hills. Yanni would need to fly straight and level for 5 miles under full flap, and with the loading ramp down. "Cutting it fine," Mech remarked, as they surveyed the rugged slopes and frowning peaks that surrounded them. "Can your fat friend fly?" "Fly? He is half bird," Nicholas told him. They moved down the valley to check the placement of the flares and the markers. The markers consisted of crosses of quartz stones laid out down the centre of the valley floor, and they would be highly visible from the air. Sapper was up at the head of the valley. They could see him there on the skyline as he moved around, setting out his smoke flares to mark the approach to the drop zone. When Nicholas turned around and looked in the opposite direction, he could see the two women sitting on a rock together at the far end of the valley. Sapper had already helped them to set up their flares. These would mark the far limit of the zone and give Yanni a mark for his climb out of the valley. Nicholas then turned his attention back to Mech's men as they finished laying out the stark white quartz markers. Once these were all in place, Mech ordered the area to be cleared. Then, lugging the radio, they climbed up to join Sapper on the high ground at the head of the valley. Mech helped Nicholas string out the aerial. Then Nicholas switched on and adjusted the gain carefully before he thumbed the microphone. "Big Dolly, come in, Big Dolly," Nicholas invited. But the static hummed and whined. "They must be running late." Nicholas tried not to let his disquiet show. "Yanni will be coming straight in from Malta on this run. After the first drop, he will go back to your base at Rosiris and pick up the second load. With luck, both loads should all be dropped before noon tomorrow." "If the fat man comes at all," Mech remarked. "Yanni's a pro," Nicholas grunted. "He'll come." He held the microphone to his lips. "Big Dolly, do you read? Big Dolly, over." Every 10 minutes he called out into the empty, echoing silence. Each time his call went unanswered, he had visions of Sudanese MiG interceptors racing in with their missiles cocked and locked, and the old Hercules plunging earthwards in flames. "Come in, Big Dolly," he pleaded. And at last a thin, scratchy voice floated into the headset. "Pharaoh, this is Big Dolly. ETA 45 minutes. Standing by." Yanni's transmission was terse. He was too much of an old hand at the smuggling game to give a hostile listener time to fix his position. "Big Dolly, understand, 4-5, Pharaoh, standing by." Nicholas grinned at Mech. "Looks like we're in business after all." Mech heard it first. His ear was battle-tuned. In this land, if you wanted to go on living, it paid to pick up any aircraft long before it arrived. Nicholas was out of training, so it was almost 5 minutes later that he picked up the distinctive drone of the multi-props echoing weirdly off the cliffs of the gorge. It was impossible to be certain of the direction, but they shaded their eyes and stared into the west. "There she is," Nicholas redeemed himself as he spotted the tiny dark speck, so low as almost to blend into the background of the escarpment wall. He nodded at Sapper. Sapper ran out to his flares and fussed over them briefly. When he backed away, they bloomed into clouds of dense marigold yellow smoke that drifted out sluggishly on the light breeze. The smoke would give Yanni the strength and direction of the wind, as well as his orientation for the drop zone. Nicholas lifted his binoculars and gazed towards the other end of the narrow valley. He saw that Ryan and Tessay were busy with their flares. Suddenly, crimson smoke billowed from them, and the women ran back to their original position and stood staring up at the sky. Nicholas called softly into the microphone. "Big Dolly, smoke is up. Do you have it visual? Affirmative. You are visual. For what you are about to receive, may you be truly thankful. Yanni's South African accent was unmistakable as he uttered the cheerful blasphemy.